Magic Lessons is supported in part by Audible.com. Audible content includes more than 250,000 audio programs from leading audiobook publishers, broadcasters, entertainers, magazines, and newspaper publishers, and business information providers. Magic Lessons listeners might enjoy a TED Talk by our incredible guest, Sarah Jones. It's called One Woman, Five Characters, and a Sex Lesson from the Future. Audible is offering Magic Lessons podcast listeners a free 30-day trial membership. Just go to audible.com/lessons and choose from over 250,000 titles and start listening. It's that easy. Go to audible.com/lessons. That's audible.com/lessons and get started today. Just a heads up, everybody. These are adults having adult conversations, so there is the possibility of adult language. Hi, everyone, and welcome to Magic Lessons, a podcast produced by MaximumFun.org. I'm Elizabeth Gilbert, and last year I wrote this book called Big Magic, Creative Living Beyond Fear. But even when I was finished with the book, I was definitely not finished with the topic because I'm still as much as ever fascinated with the intricacies of the creative process and how we find our way through that strange journey, the obstacles we meet along the way, and the joy of what we ultimately create. And it is through my desire to keep having that conversation that this, the Magic Lessons podcast, was born. So here we are. Season 2, and we are back with more real conversations with real people, amateurs and experts. This season, we will be meeting poets and novelists, dancers, photographers, comedians, and whether they're ready or not, me and my friends are going to help them figure out how to shake off their fear, get unstuck, and start making stuff. You know why? Because I think they are ready. So let's go. Today, I'm talking to Joe Cheatham in the UK. Hi, is that Joe?
Hello, yes it is.
Oh, hi lovely, how are you?
I'm good, thank you, how are you?
I'm wonderful, thank you so much for being part of this.
Thank you so much for phoning me, this is really exciting.
And you have a definitely made for podcasting voice, that's extremely exciting for me.
Are you kidding me? I've got the worst voice in the world.
Oh, we're going to start with putting ourselves down right away.
Well, I'm English. That's what we do.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Self-deprecation capital of the world.
Yeah.
Okay, I'm American, so it's going to be like self-affirmation capital of the world. So we're just going to have a battle between deprecation and affirmation. How does that sound? Somewhere we'll find the happy medium. Joe, I got to tell you, I should tell everybody who's listening that the way we did season 2 of the Magic Lessons podcast is that I put out this call on social media for people saying, do you have a project that you want to do or a creative obstacle? And then I gave them this tiny little space in which to write their story. And not to pick favorites, Joe, but yours was my favorite.
Wow.
Because it just immediately made me laugh. So I'm wondering if you could start us off just by reading it, because I think it will really immediately establish both what's going on with you and why I thought you were so charming. So do you mind doing that for us?
I have it here, and there's a chocolate biscuit on it, Liz.
Oh, good.
Nice.
Excellent.
I'll save that for later. I knew from the age of 5 that I wanted to be a comedy writer. I spent my entire childhood writing funny stories and scripts, and my goal was to make at least one person belly laugh every day. So, what did I do when I grew up? Yeah, that's right, I did a PhD all about the Holocaust and death and suffering. And then I became a feminist campaigner, immersed in stories of violence and inequality and pain. Well, the PhD and the campaign are finished, and the comedy writing passion is still burning. But how can I find the fun again?
A statement that has that many references to Holocaust, suffering, pain, and violence shouldn't make me laugh as much as it did. But it's like, it's that amazing dichotomy between, you know, I have a calling and the calling is to make people laugh. So of course I became a PhD in Holocaust studies. So you already achieved, while I was reading through thousands of essays, your goal in just a few sentences of making somebody belly laugh, right?
Oh, so good. Clearly, well, I didn't mean to do that.
Yeah, well, apparently your childhood aspirations are not as far out of reach as you may think.
Oh, good.
Tell me a little bit more about what you're doing right now and what you want to be doing either instead or in addition to what you're doing right now.
Okay, well, let me tell you sort of how this happened, sort of like comedy to genocide. Well, so I knew from a really young age that I wanted to tell stories that would make people laugh. And that's because, really, I grew up in a really funny household. You know, my brothers and my sister were 10 to 15 years older than me, and I'd sort of lie in bed listening to them, laughing their heads off with my mum and dad downstairs. You know, and I'd think, oh, I want to be like you. You know, I want to make people laugh. And the thing is that, you know, the house was always full of laughter, but we didn't have it really easy. You know, we never had any money, and we lived in a place with a lot of crime and poverty, and I was bullied all the way through school. But at home, there was always something to laugh about, and we just weren't allowed to take ourselves too seriously. And, you know, that was something that really sort of pushed me through all the hard stuff. So it was really central to who I was. But then when I was 16, at school we had to have a careers advisory meeting. And I told the careers advisor that I wanted to be a comedy writer. And he said, oh, well, that's not a job. You can't do that. That's not a job. And I was really sort of broken by it because I was a really stupid child. And I just believed everything that adults told me. So I said, well, you know, if I can't do that, maybe I could go to university and do English. I was, you know, I'm good at that. And he said, listen, let me give you some advice. You know, in a few years, you're going to be married, you're going to have kids, and a degree is not going to help you. You know, it's not going to help you. That's not for you. You need to get some life experience and, you know, like get a job that will pay the bills and learn how to run a home. He actually said that to me, and, you know, it wasn't in the 50s. That was in the 90s.
Oh, my fucking God. Sorry, I just have to throw that in there. Terrific. I mean, it's just good to know that there's such able professionals working in the school with young women's lives. But anyway, go on.
He's the same person who told my sister, who was an absolute genius at school. She said she liked animals, so he told her to marry a farmer.
Oh, my God.
Not to be a farmer, even, but to just marry a farmer.
So
I got an obsession with proving him wrong, but I wasn't clever enough to work out that I could just carry on writing, you know, and work in a pub or at the post office or whatever and just write. I didn't think about that. So I thought, well, he said I can't go to university, so I've got to go to university, like, you know, forever.
Right.
So that's what I did. So I did my undergraduate degree and my master's, and then I did a PhD. You know, subject matter probably as serious as you can get, really, which is the Holocaust and refugees from Nazi Germany. And at the same time as I was doing that, I was doing all the feminist campaigning, so it was all really heavy stuff.
Yeah.
And, I mean, it was an amazing opportunity, and I'm so grateful that people trusted me and shared all these stories and their family's stories. It's absolutely incredible that they did that. So, I mean, I just got really ill. You know, my hair was falling out in huge clumps, and I ended up in hospital. And I was just completely exhausted. Like, I was just totally empty.
Yeah.
You know, I was so far away from the person who I was before I did any of this stuff.
Yeah.
So, last year, I finished the PhD, and I finished the campaign. And I moved from London up into a really rural part of northern England with my boyfriend who works here. So I feel like I've got a fresh start.
Yeah.
And the thing is that the dream I had as a kid of doing the comedy writing, it never went away. And, you know, you hear about people who are on the wrong path and they have a voice that whispers to them.
Uh-huh.
You know, I didn't have that. I had a voice that was screaming in my face, like all the time, even when I was asleep. Like, what are you doing?
Yeah.
Like, this is wrong. But if you've got a scholarship to study the Holocaust, you can't just say, oh, actually, you know, this is a bit heavy.
Yeah.
I want to just write jokes. You can't really say that, can you? So I had to carry on.
Oh, Joe. Oh, my goodness. Well, this is very exciting. You know, this is like, I have like chills up my spine. I'm like, all right, let's do this. Let's.
Oh, good.
I mean, the wonderful thing that's so exciting about it is that it's also terribly obvious what you're supposed to be doing, right? I mean, oftentimes I talk to people who feel a sort of general underlying vibrational sense of malaise, and they're sort of walking around in a mist with their hands outstretched, you know, looking for something to grab hold to, you know, in the middle of this just misty soup of confusion. You don't have that. You don't just have a calling. You have a screaming. I mean, it's not – you used it yourself. It's not just that this voice is beckoning to you. This voice is like hollering in your ear, and not just your internal voice, by the way, but also your body, you know, which is the ultimate litmus test of if you're doing the right thing and in the right place, because your body cannot be bullshitted, right? Like, I mean, your mind is capable of playing all sorts of games with itself and creating all sorts of narratives and storylines, but your body won't swallow those. You know, your body just takes it for what it is, which is poison. You know, like what you were doing was poisoning you. Your hair was falling out. That's what happens to people when they're deeply ill. So all these truths that you were constructing and attempting to swallow, your body's just spitting up as toxin, toxin, toxin. Like, I'm not having it. And the good news is it keeps telling you what you're supposed to be doing. And I would say that, just to let you know, Joe, none of this has been wasted, you know, for so many reasons. Everything that you've done is perfect. You needed to prove, not so much to the guidance counselor, of course, who is just a tool in this story and also a tool, just in general. You needed to prove to some part of yourself that you're a serious person, that you're capable of being a serious person, or that seriousness is capable of holding your attention, right? That you can finish things that you started, that you set out to get a degree and that you did it, and that you were responsible and that you showed up, and you've proven that. So the work is not wasted for that reason, because it's given you a baseline gravitas of your selfhood that you know that you have substance. You know you have weight. There's things I've had to do in my life that were not suited to me, but I had to do them to prove to myself that I had weight, mm-hmm. you know, and that I wasn't just with one foot with the fairies, which is kind of actually seriously where I am. But I know it's like I showed up, I did that job, I was responsible, I'm a grown up, I paid those bills. Okay, it's been shown, it's been proven. Now can we go back to what I'm supposed to be doing? You know, so you've done that. And of course, the second reason that it's not wasted is that you did good work. You know, you did good work for a good reason, for good causes. You cared, you showed up, and you were respectful of people's darkest stories. And it took a toll on you. And I think, I mean, if you're looking for somebody to give you permission to say that you're done with that, or at least done with that version of that, then I would happily write that permission slip for you.
Yes, please.
It's done. You know, I may even, what I'm going to do actually, I'm making a note to myself, write permission slip to Joe. I'm going to actually physically do that and write that down. And I'm also going to try to remind you that when you spoke of your childhood wish to want to be a comedian, what you didn't say, even as a child, was, I want to be a comedian because I want the attention. I want to be a comedian because I want to be rich and famous. I want to be a comedian because I want to meet celebrities. Just say it again. Tell me one more time why you wanted to do this. What was the motive?
Well, it was just, I wanted to be like my family. You know, when things are really hard, if you can just bring a little bit of happiness, a little bit of joy just for a moment, then that's everything, isn't it?
And it's bringing joy to who?
Anyone
who needs it. It's a public service, Joe. Like, what was happening with your work that you were doing is that you were taking public service too literally, in the only framework that our culture has to explain what a public service is. I want to be a person of service. Okay, well, then you become a social worker, or you become a hospice nurse, or you go to Africa and you dig wells for people, or you collect genocide survivor stories in order to bring cases to The Hague. You know, like, these are things that serious people do when they want to be of service. And those things are valid because that's part of it, but it's not the only thing. And there's a poem that I love and reference all the time. In fact, I have a piece of it tattooed on me. I begin my book, Big Magic, with a reference to this poet and to this poem. And I want to tell you about it because I feel like it speaks to you. And there's a line in that poem. I'm not going to make you get a tattoo of it on you, but I am going to make you memorize it because I think it's really essential to the shift that you want to make. So the poem is called A Brief for the Defense, and it's by the poet Jack Gilbert. And the first line of it is, sorrow everywhere, slaughter everywhere. If babies are not starving someplace, they are starving somewhere else with flies in their nostrils. And he goes on from there to talk about the world of suffering that we live in. And he does it in this way that's so unblinking, just states it as a fact that this is so. And then he says, but we enjoy our lives because that's what God wants. Otherwise, the mornings before summer dawn would not be made so fine. The Bengal tiger would not be fashioned so miraculously well. And this is the line that you not only know, but you've lived, because you grew up in a family with hardship where there was a lot of laughter, right? So he says, the poor women at the fountain are laughing together between the suffering they have known and the awfulness in their future, smiling and laughing while someone in the village is very sick. There is laughter every day in the terrible streets of Calcutta, and the women laugh in the cages in Bombay. And then he has this line, which is so important. If we deny our happiness and resist our satisfaction, we lessen the importance of their deprivation. It's a long poem, and part of it I have written on me, which is, we must have the stubbornness to accept our gladness in the ruthless furnace of this world. But the line that I think is really important for you and for anybody who feels like the only work that matters on earth is the work of being in the front lines of the ultimate suffering, right? For anybody who's locked in that belief that that's the only way to serve humankind, this is the line that I love and that I want you to memorize. To make injustice the only measure of our attention is to praise the devil. And he doesn't say disregard injustice. He doesn't say that injustice is not worth our attention. He never claims that it's not important, but he says to make it the only measure of our attention is to praise the devil. Because there, Joe, if you elect to believe that, you know, that the only thing that's valid is to praise darkness, you become darkness, right?
Yeah.
As your body knew, you become another suffering person. And what the world does not need, assuredly, is another suffering person. And the people who are made to do the kind of work that you were trying to do, that work will bring them to life. And that's how you'll know that that's their calling. I know people who are in the front lines of the war against suffering. And the only ones I know who are effective at it are the ones who only feel ignited and illuminated and alive when they are doing that work. They bloom there.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the symptom and the proof that that's what they're supposed to be doing, right? And
yeah.
That's what we need them to be doing. And they do it beautifully. And not only that, the recipients of their charitable impulses and the recipients of their grace and their love and their kindness heal better because they're being healed by somebody who wants to be there. And every time in my life, anybody has helped me because they're supposed to, or they should, or they feel like they're doing some sort of duty, it has not helped me.
Yeah.
And anytime anybody has helped me because it brought them to life to be around me doing this work, I've been healed as well. You know, so if your body and your mind are breaking down, you're not where you're supposed to be. You know, that's it. And you're also not helping. So you're not helping. I mean, you've helped already as much as you are physically and emotionally capable of helping. And now it's time to turn your attention to the thing that you might do that might be of help. And I also want to add that this doesn't mean that you have to do political comedy. Okay? This doesn't mean that you have to, like, do comedy about serious issues. And there are people who do that. You know,
I tried that and it didn't work.
It almost never does. there are people who do it, and there are people who do it really well, and they have a rare gift and they have a specialty, and that's for them. So what I want to release you from are two things. I want to release you from feeling like the only way to be a serious presence in the world is by being on the front lines of every serious battle of suffering. Unless you love it there, don't do it. You know, you're not helping. And the second thing I want to release you from is you don't have to take that into your work. I want you to feel free to do the work that brings you to life and illuminates you, and that is how you will serve. You, sick and dying with your hair falling out, ain't doing anybody any good.
So good to hear someone say that to me. This is wonderful. It's wonderful.
Yeah, I hope so. I mean, look, my friend Martha Beck always says, she quotes the Buddha. Well, let's go back further. The Buddha always says that, you know, that you can always tell ocean water, no matter what ocean in the world it's from, the ocean always tastes like salt. And you can always tell enlightenment because enlightenment always tastes like freedom. You know? Always tastes like freedom. And anything that doesn't taste like freedom is not your path, you know? It's less about chasing your hunger with a sort of starving ambition than it is about letting your body and your soul tell you what tastes like freedom, and that's the thing. Does that sound right?
It sounds so good. It sounds so good. And I just want to tell you really quickly about what happened when I did actually try to do sort of political satire.
Yeah, go ahead.
I had a blog for a while with a friend, and we would read all of the sexist articles in newspapers and sort of make fun of them. And you know, it did well and all that kind of stuff, but it made me really quite anxious because I'd have to look through all of the newspaper articles in the first place to make fun of them. So I was taking on all this crap all the time. But I wrote one specific post. It was the only time I ever wrote about a specific person, and he was a former editor of a newspaper who was responsible for a lot of sort of, you know, sexist stuff that was going on. And I made quite a lot of fun of him, actually, in this article, and I just don't do that ever. Mm. And I instantly felt guilty about it. I felt horribly guilty about it. And what happened is that 6 months later, my boyfriend's mum met him somewhere, and they're now in a relationship, and they live together.
Oh, karma.
So that was a lesson.
Oh, my God. Wait, and you have to, like, sit next to this guy at weddings?
Well,
and things? I mean,
I've only
that
had
will
to do it once
yeah.
so far, but yeah.
You'll have to do it again.
Yeah, I know.
Oh,
that, it's
Lord.
My fault. I made that happen.
Well, look, now we know you're a powerful sorceress.
Yeah.
Oh, my God, Joe.
Yeah.
Oh, that's funny. Well, see,
it's awkward. It's very awkward.
It's very awkward. And also, when you did that, it didn't taste good, right?
It was awful. And it's, I still feel guilty about it now.
And you wouldn't have gone into the humanitarian-centered line of work that you've been in if you want to bring human beings down, right? Like, that's not your jam, you know?
It's not who I am. And I was bullied for years. I don't ever want to be a bully myself, ever.
No, you don't have to be. You know, a friend of mine pointed this out one time, which I think is really incredible, my friend Rob Bell. He said, you know, people don't want to pursue the thing that they really love because they feel like it's selfish. But if you ever have the opportunity to meet somebody who has pursued the thing they love and their work has delighted and affected and moved and stirred you, right? So like your favorite musician or a great songwriter or a fantastic comic or anybody who's putting something into the world that you love, that has fed and nourished you, when you meet that person, to a man, all of us, the first thing we say to that person is what? What do we say? Thank you.
Yeah.
Thank you. And it's such, and as Rob pointed out, it's a really weird thing to say because they didn't do it for you. You know, when I got to meet Toni Morrison and I said thank you to her, it's not like she's like, oh, yes, you're welcome. I did this, you know, I wrote those books for you. You know, she was doing the work that she was called to do that illuminated her to life. And by doing so, she becomes a torch in the world that lights me so that when I'm with her, all I want to do is express my gratitude to be around somebody who's alive and illuminated and awake and whose work makes me feel like the world is full of possibility and beauty and comfort in a way, right? So the ones who follow the most selfish path are the ones who get thanked the most. Right?
It's so true. And
right?
I never thought of that before.
It's a community service, Joe. It's a community service. You'll be doing a community service. So the thing is that I normally, when I do these podcasts, I normally give people assignments and send them out in the world with an assignment. But I don't think I have to do that with you because I think that your mind, body, and spirit have already given you your assignment. So what I want to ask you is, given everything that we've said here, and even like just putting yourself in the mind of what would I need to do the thing that would bring me to life and start to illuminate you, you tell me what your assignment is. And I'll just give a stamp of approval.
Well, there's something I've been working on for a while. So it's a comic novel, and I've just been getting really stuck lately because, you know, when your sort of really annoying part of your brain whizzes into gear and it tells you you're an idiot and you're fat and you're doing rubbish work, well, that was just working a lot. And it was saying, you know, there's no value, there's no worthiness in doing something that's just fun. You know, it's got to mean something. So I was just, I'd like written characters that I love, and I was killing them off to try and make it horrible.
Also, you got that genocide fixation, man.
I'm a psychopath, aren't I? That's just horrible. Yeah, I've got to get rid of that genocide.
That's it. Can we just like, can we just drop the genocide for a while, Joe? Even in your comedy? We're talking about life affirmation, not, you know, life eradication. Can we keep your happy characters alive?
I think that's my assignment, to keep my characters alive and to try and, you know, write the thing that my heart says to write and not to try and make it valid in some way or worthy in some way, to just keep it clear of all the stuff that my stupid part of my brain tells me I've got to do to make it worthwhile and valuable. and to actually just do what I want to do and to see what happens then.
Okay, awesome. I love it. Part two, you're not allowed to call any part of your brain a stupid part anymore because
okay, I'll try.
Even if you're dissecting that part away from yourself by saying it's the stupid part of myself, you're calling yourself stupid and like that's not going to get you anywhere. So that's off.
Okay.
That's done. And the next thing is I actually just realized I do have an assignment for you. Besides, besides, please stop murdering people that you love. my next assignment beyond that is I want you to make a list of 10 creative people in the world whose work has illuminated your life who are pure entertainers.
Oh, okay.
And then I want you to go through that list and I want you to write like just a couple words after each name about what they gave you, what their work has given you, so that you can see what it's like to be on the receiving end of somebody who's generously selfishly following their own path, right? And then I want you to pick one of those people and I want you to write them a thank you letter.
That's so lovely.
Isn't that nice?
I'd love to do that. That's lovely.
Because you're British, you're polite. You know how to write a thank you note.
I'll have a cup of tea and write it,
And they never need to see it. I mean, it may go through an assistant and never be seen. They may see it, they may respond, they may not.
I don't have to send it.
Oh, you do.
Oh, that's hard for me. Okay.
You do. You do. You have to send it.
Okay, yeah.
You have to send it. And it has to be in your real voice, you know? Not genocide Joe, but joyful Joe. Joe, your name is like one letter away from the word joy. You're so close to joy.
I'm nearly there.
You're nearly there. The only letter that's missing is Y. Like, why are you still Genocide Joe when you're supposed to be Joy Joe? So write them a really earnest and funny and light and like just say thanks and be specific about what that person's path brought to your path. And then keep a copy of that. And every time what Annie Lamott calls radio K-fucked, that's 24 hours a day in your mind telling you what a failure and a loser you are, take out that letter and read it as a reminder of what you know to be true, which is that when people do the work that they're supposed to be doing, they are living in service of the world because you know that because you've been served, right? Mm. You've been served and your life has been made better by people who did the work that brought them to light. And that's your assignment. So listen, Joe, you know how this podcast works, that I always try to bring in an expert to give even more advice because there's a lot of people who are in fields of creativity that I'm not in who I think could maybe help you a little bit more with your situation. So the person who I'm bringing in to help you is my great friend, Sarah Jones. She's a performance artist and an actress and a Tony and Obie Award winning, amazing stage presence and a comedian. But she also does really highly politicized work.
Fantastic.
In other words, she does exactly the opposite of what I just told you to stop trying to do. But I want to talk to her about, you know, just performance in general and art in general, but also specifically about how we merge our political selves and our artistic selves. And then, you know, you'll get to listen to that and be like you have a little extra fairy godmother. And then if it's all right with you, I'm going to call you at the end of the summer and see how it's going with your work. Is that okay?
Yes, please. I would love that. And that sounds wonderful. Thank you.
Excellent. You will love Sarah. Or rather, I should say you will love all the Sarahs because she's composed of many different characters, many of whom I believe we will probably be meeting on this podcast when she shows up. She's awesome. And I think she'll have an affinity for you automatically. So listen, I want to say it again. I read thousands of entries and I got a belly laugh reading that email that you sent. This is what you're meant to be, you know?
Thank you so much. I still can't believe you phoned me. No one phones me here apart from my mom. So that's
now it's
really
the two
lovely.
Of us. All right, sweetie, go forth and enjoy.
I will. Thank you so much.
You're welcome. Bye.
Bye.
Okay, that was awesome. we're going to take a quick break, and when we come back, I'll be talking with the extraordinary Sarah Jones about Joe and about comedy and about suffering and about love, life, and art. It'll be terrific, but first, a word from our sponsors. Okay, so here's the deal, guys. If you're listening to this podcast, then it's evidence that you're a curious person. And if you're a curious person, then you're obviously, like me, somebody who loves learning and probably feels like they aren't done learning. And if that's who you are, then you will love The Great Courses Plus. They've brought together these incredible professors to create these videos that you can watch on any device anywhere in your life, and you can learn stuff that you wouldn't be able to learn unless you were going to like Harvard, which you probably don't have time to do right now in your life. And we have an incredible opportunity right now that the Great Courses Plus is offering one free month membership so that you can log in and see if you like it. And I recently just watched one of their videos on the science of mindfulness, which you know I am all about, and I thought it was incredible and amazing. But they have like dozens, hundreds, thousands, billions of more topics that you can start to explore. If you want to start your free month trial, you go to thegreatcoursesplus.com. So that's the whole thing, thegreatcoursesplus.com/lessons. That word lessons is your secret code for you to be able to try this for a month. So remember to go to thegreatcoursesplus.com/lessons and you'll get a month free membership. You can explore it as much as you like, and then you can learn for like ever, which I know you want to do because that's the kind of person you are.
Hi, I'm comedian Emily Heller.
And I'm cartoonist Lisa Hannawalt.
And we're the hosts of Baby Geniuses.
Do you want to learn weird new facts?
Do you like hearing successful, creative women talk about their poop?
Do you want the scoop on Martha Stewart's pony?
If you answered yes to any of these questions, our show is for you.
We interview people like Paul F. Tompkins,
Kristen Shaw,
Michael Che,
and more. So check us out on Maximum Fun.
And let us mess up your brain.
Yes, please.
Baby Geniuses, we know everything. Baby Geniuses, tell us something we don't know.
Okay, we are back. Before the break, we heard from Jo in the UK, who is wondering if she has permission to stop devoting her life to the study of darkness and suffering and whether she can return to joy and laughter. Now it is time to bring in Sarah Jones, a rather shockingly over-talented artist, actor, producer, writer, performer, comedian, and deeply passionate social activist, also a very good friend of mine. Hi, Sarah.
Hi, Liz.
How are you, darling?
All of us are so...
We're like so stoked to be here with you right now, Liz. I shouldn't let Bella... Hi, I'm Bella. I just had to like take over and say this is so rad. Okay, Sarah can come back now.
I love you.
All you know I love Bella. So
she loves you too.
Because she's a feminist, right?
Yeah. I was actually like named for like Bella Abzug. It's like a famous feminist from like
super
history.
Famous.
Yeah.
Super famous.
Yeah.
Sarah, Bella, everyone, all of you, any of you are welcome to jump in on the mic at any time whatsoever. Let me tell you what we're doing here today. I ask people for their obstacles and their problems and their issues around creativity. And then I try to help them. And then I try to double down by bringing in a superpower pro to give expert advice in the realm that the person lives in. So Jo, who I just talked to, lives in the UK. I loved her from the beginning, from her essay that she wrote for her application to be on the Magic Lessons podcast, where she said that essentially her whole life, all she wanted to do was be a comedian and make people laugh. And then she accidentally went and got a PhD in Holocaust studies and genocide and violence against women. And
that will really, really destroy your comedy career to start with. I mean, I just want to say that it must have been so fantastic, first of all, to hear her letter, knowing it was probably being spoken somewhat like this. So everything's deadpan and funny anyway. And then she gets to all of that.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, it's great. And guess what happened? You'll never guess what happened to Dear Jo when she accidentally went into studies of death and violence and injustice instead of becoming a creature of light and laughter and joy. She got really sick.
Oh, no.
I know, isn't that weird? You wouldn't think. She got sick. Her hair started falling out. Her life started dying out from under her. And now she's in her mid-30s and she's just done. She's ready to do my favorite thing, which is to voluntarily renounce suffering.
Love it.
And find the path of illumination for herself. Mm-hmm. And she wants to get into comedy writing. And she wants to do it from a place of joy, right? So before we get to big issues about social justice and the place in the artist's life for these questions, which I know you have spent a lot of time thinking about, wrestling with, dealing with, making work out of.
And getting help from you with. Thank you very much.
Let's just talk about the impulse to entertain. Let's take it down to its purest crystal, the germ at the beginning of it all. Tell me about what that is in you and where that came from in you, because you are many, many, many things, but you're at the core for me is that tremendous wit and the joy in the absurd and the laughter. Like, there's so much laughter in you and around you, no matter what the subject is that you're taking on. And I want to know what you sort of think that is spiritually, emotionally, intellectually in your life and in your work.
Mm, thank you for that. I feel so connected to Jo without ever having met her. And sorry, Jo, if your accent's nothing like this, you might be from anywhere in the UK. So sorry to not to pin you down. But as you can tell, I have so much in common with a person who wants to play in that joyful space of laughing and making others, you know, like showing others a mirror that kind of lightens their load. And then finding, you know, for Jo to find herself, oops, I stepped into, you know, kind of genocide on a scale beyond anything anybody can imagine. And that's where I'm spending all my time. How did this happen? I really get that. And I almost want to say for me, those two impulses are one. I come from a family that was spectacularly vibrant and filled with fantastical characters and wonderful, eccentric, high-achieving people who were also very, very messy. And so the joy and the lightness and the laughter had an undercurrent of pain and confusion and suffering. And on top of all of that, it was multicultural. My parents met when my mother, who is a white-appearing, very white for the world's purposes. So she would walk around and people were like, hey, white girl. And she arrived at Johns Hopkins, where she met my dad, at a time when it was the first time women were ever allowed to live on campus. So there's your feminist movement. Mm-hmm. Collides with the first class of critical mass of black people ever to arrive, my dad, walking around with his afro. And so these two movements, the kind of swirl of, you know, geopolitical realities around them, kind of lifted these two individuals out of their homes and into each other's lives. And then I was born like 5 seconds later. Mm-hmm. And I really think that mix of kind of, you know, pathos and the deep love for ourselves that drives all the laughter that's real, those two things are really intertwined. And then how we make a joyful life for ourselves. Somebody said, I love this idea. What if joy is my only metric for success?
Yeah.
That changes everything, right? Yeah. So I think Jo's got everything she needs.
Yeah.
And like me, I think she gets to fumble around a little bit and probably go through some uncomfortable, I won't say self-interrogation, but maybe sitting down and befriending some of the more difficult parts of herself.
Do you have trouble trusting joy?
Oh, God. You know, it's funny. I think because I didn't know joy very well, like it was so, you know, I would kind of catch a flash of it and be like, what was that? Did you see that? Oh, my God. What was that thing? And my characters gave me access to joy when I was little. So my parents would be away a lot and I would entertain myself. And so people you've met, Liz, and who hopefully your listeners will get to meet. Let's see if she'll
come
out now.
Can you bring somebody
up for
us? I'm
going to bring somebody up.
Yeah. Okay, I'm going to come out now.
I was hoping Lorraine would be here.
I was hoping you were hoping.
Hi,
so
darling.
It works out very well. Hi, sweetheart. I wish you out there could see this gorgeous creature. I know you know what she looks like, but it's different when you're in her presence. She really does glow. It's gorgeous. Anyway.
That's not your cataracts, Lorraine.
It's not my cataract. Listen, and she's funny. But here's what I want to say about the joy. So Sarah, when she was little, she would be so worried and concerned. Bubula, I would call her. She's like a little grandmother, you know, already. And I would say, why don't you play? Why don't you stop worrying? What will happen to this? What will happen to that? She was living in the future. 3 years old. What'll happen when I'm four? You know what I mean? So sometimes joy is, if you're not familiar with it, it's frightening. Like anything else, you have to adjust. So that I hope everybody out there is getting a joy adjustment. Keep going back. It's like the chiropractor. Well, maybe not. We'll talk about that another time.
So lovely. you know, thank you, Lauren. You know, I love her so much, and I find her so calming. You know, she's the deep, eternal goddess of it's all going to be all right, you know, even when it isn't.
You know, that's only because I'm in my late 80s. Please, whatever you do, try to look ahead. You know, a lot of us, we do those exercises. I think you have one, Liz, where you imagine, who am I going to be when I'm 87, 88? And what would I say to me now?
Besides, just for God's sake, stop with the wrinkle cream and everything else. You look gorgeous. You're going to look back and say, I was such a looker and I didn't even realize it. So enjoy it now. Anyway.
You're miraculous.
I bring out your inner Jew. That's my favorite part. You're over there saying, oi.
Oi. Look, speaking of inner Jews, and weren't we just, Sarah and Lorraine, you both remind me of a story that I love so much about a friend of mine whose mother was a Holocaust survivor who lost her entire family. And this woman was a Viennese Jew, family died. She escaped to Haiti, which interestingly, in this time of refugee crisis, it's nice to know that Haiti took a bunch of refugees from Europe during World War II. A little known piece of history. And she then met my friend's father, who also was one of the only members of his family to survive. They were both really young. She was 17 and he was 19 or something. And they fell in love and spent their whole life together and had a beautiful love story and had children. And when her son, who's my friend, was in his angsty 20s and hung out with a bunch of other friends and they smoked cigarettes and read The Existentialists and tried to look for the darkness the way that so many creative artists are drawn to do because they feel like it's a truer story than the light. She would come to him and she would say, Paul, why don't you and your friends want to go play tennis? Do you ever just want to go outside in the sun and play tennis? This is a woman who had seen the worst horrors that humans can, and she wasn't, she was serious. She was like, it's a beautiful day. You're young. You've got these lovely bodies. Tennis is nice. You know, why do you want to sit here and read Camus? You know, like, don't you want to get outside?
And you put down the nihilism for just a second?
And then she would say, what's so bad about the world?
Wow.
What's so bad about the world that you want to hide from it inside in the dark?
Wow.
You know, and gave him permission to consider becoming a person of light, you know? And you can't look at someone like that and say, how naive.
Right. You don't know what you're talking about.
Because she knows.
Because she knows. She knows. You know, the hand wringing and brow furrowing as a kind of badge of dark honor somehow. I really remember that from college. And
that's what college is for.
That's what college is for. It's totally. It's for a little ennui and you have to smoke a lot and drink a lot of coffee and become French. It's very important. The futility of life. It sounds better when you.
I will smile when they stop killing whales.
Exactly. Although I do need them to kill a few whales for my lipstick. But other than that, I smile when they stop. My pout is not the same without some whales, a few. You know, I didn't realize that the, again, when we're talking about the Holocaust, when we're talking about, or for example, the Native American genocide, which I've written about and I have a character who's Native American. And, you know, he's a stand-up comedian.
Can he join us?
Well, I was waiting for you to ask, but I thought, you know, I don't want to encroach. I mean, it is your land.
Oh, my God.
I'm just a visitor. Just taking a little time off the res here.
I think Gary's there. He wakes me up. He wakes me up. And the wakefulness of joy and light and having come through your darkness and befriending your darkness, accommodating, making space for your darkness as part of your art and your work. I didn't know that that's a requirement. That's not an option. You got to do that. If you don't, I didn't realize that I was committing, this is going to sound really dramatic, but it is so true, a kind of incremental suicide. It's so slow. It's such a subtle drip. You don't even know it's happening. It's the moment I took a call from my agent to do a TV show that I knew I didn't want to do, where I was a side, you know, my characters would be sidekicks to, you know, the fill in the blank straight white male Christian guy who is the palatable person. Person who will offset all the wackiness of my multicultiness. And I thought, I don't want to be at the margins. I do this work because I believe these voices belong in the center. And I didn't know that my decision making was being driven by this kind of slow percolating self-abandonment and art abandonment. And I think if we abandon our darkness, we abandon our capacity for joy in a way that is really subtle.
And you said something when we spoke last
that I have now said on stage after stage after stage around these United States and the world over the last year, which was, I want you to know, I footnote you on it. Mm. You said, if I'm about to go on a creative journey, it's the highway that I have to be driving down. And the minute I start asking questions like, will this sell? Is this serious enough? Is this important enough? Will my agent be able to market this? Is this what my audience is expecting of me next? All of those are exit ramps off the highway that you need to be on. And as you said, when I get off those highways, on those any of those exit ramps, I end up in very bad neighborhoods where I get mugged and they take my hubcaps off my car. Like, what has to happen is just, what is the work that is calling me to make it? Am I doing that work? Then you're on the right highway. Anything else is a departure off of that, you know?
God. Thank you. I need to hear that right now.
Well, my friend Sarah Jones said it. And if you ever get the chance to hang out with her.
I really will. I'll let her know.
She's wise. She is wise. It wasn't even one of her characters. So that was flat up, straight out Sarah Jones.
Oh, wow.
It's amazing how we have to be reminded of what we not only know, but teach.
Wow. You know, and thank you for that. And they say we teach it because we need to learn it, right? Yeah. And it's funny. I'm thinking about the play I'm working on now, which is the first one since Bridge and Tunnel. And it's premiering in September in New York. Woo! It's called Sell by Date. And it's going to be at Manhattan Theater Club. So if you're on this island and Gary wishes you would sell it back to him. But if you happen to be on Manhattan, please come in September to Sell by Date. But I mention it in...
This is a deeply serious topic that you've made your play out of, I know.
Topic. So yeah. When you mentioned Joe and, you know, having gotten a PhD in Holocaust survivor studies and in, you know, kind of the study of that, really what amounts to a scar across the face of humanity, right? And we have those events that, for me, they're etched on all of us, no matter what our background. I feel that way about slavery in America and the Americas in general. I feel that way about the Native American Holocaust and everything else I learn as I move through the world about genocides and the horrors human beings can visit on others, really meaning themselves, right? Because we know there are no others. So that's the kind of the sickest, most twisted thing about these scars is that they're reminders that over and over again, we do this to ourselves because there is no other. But I am working with Sell by Date. And when I say working with it, this is a collaborative effort between me, Sarah, the sometimes very frightened artist person, but ultimately very trusting. I believe the universe is trustworthy. Mm-hmm. And I believe my decision to explore topics of sex work, prostitution, trafficking, how we name those things, the kind of political issues that come up when you talk about women's freedom to, you know, do whatever they need to do to survive, but also how free are you if your only choice is to, you know, be in a situation that might not feel great to you. All of that subject matter does not sound like the stuff of a rib-tickling evening at the theater.
No, it doesn't.
It really doesn't.
As doesn't most of the work that you've done, and yet people are rolling in the aisles, laughing, crying, living and breathing the power of your work when you do it, you know? But go on. I interrupted. I want you to finish that thought.
Well, yeah. I think this, for me, is about the conversation that we're getting to have with Jo, which is so fabulous that she's here with us in a certain important way, that I really get having my life sort of feel like it's, I won't use the word disintegrating, but that my life is rebelling against me somehow. My body, my, you know, you described her having physical ailments and all kinds of stuff come up. I was in a place where every part of my artist self was crying out for a pause and a reassessment of what was important and a willingness on my part to go where it doesn't feel marketable. So the finger that's beckoning me is pointing to sex work and trafficking and all of these things that don't sound funny. And my agent said, aren't you going to write a musical? When are you going to write the musical? Right. And I thought, this is more important than my ego needs, and I'm willing to withstand the discomfort of shifting out of, you know, cultivating my self-image in the world and trying to make money so that I can pay attention to my true self and cultivate that. And then a better image, P.S., is inevitable when you really become you. You know, she may find that her comedy and her, you know, deep knowledge of this incredible chasm that so many people might fall into and never be able to climb out, she might offer people a rope ladder that they can, you know, kind of latch onto and find some lightness, some sense of hope. I'd be really curious to see whether these worlds aren't as separate as they may feel.
Well, for the moment, I gave her a big fat permission slip to make light work.
Okay, great.
But what I suspect, entre nous, is that at some point in her life, nothing we ever study or care about is wasted, and nothing ever doesn't get used. Oof. And so I gave her permission to not have to make political work because she said she was trying to deliberately make political comedy and it wasn't funny at all, it often isn't, and it's hard to be.
Right.
So my assignment for her was to step out of the darkness for a while and write for pleasure and joy and fun. And then over time, we'll see, right? Life is long and Joe is young. And everything that's in her will be used. This is the rule of the artist, right? Everything will be used. It just doesn't need to be used right now. And it might not be used in the ways that seem obvious or, you know, it'll come out.
Oh, so true.
But it doesn't mean that she has to make work out of the same subject. She already wrote a doctoral thesis. She doesn't have to do a comedy doctoral thesis.
No, that would be a lot. I can't even imagine what those thesis advisors would be like. Two drink minimum.
Can one of your lovely people come into the room and talk about the support that he or she is giving to Sarah to allow you to forget about creating work that you think will please and satisfy your agents, your audiences, the critics, and even some older part of yourself of what you thought you were going to be doing? And who's firing you up to let you do this? Whose voices are you hearing?
So I want to just first of all say, my name is Nereida. I've met you before. I call you Luz because, first of all, you made a hilarious joke about that. But in Spanish, the word Luz, L-U-Z, it means light. And so I just think it's fun to like switch one letter and just like, you know, just get rid of all of the like, you know, stuff in the middle. You're a light. So I love that. I'm Dominican. Actually, I'm half Dominican, half Puerto Rican, but I'm all proud, as I always say. But I wanted to say that like you made such a good point because actually Sarah Jones, like before I met her and everything, she was thinking about writing something about trafficking like a really long time ago. She was like, oh, my God, this issue is so important. She was like going to prisons and reading, you know, poetry to girls that were there, like incarcerated, crazy, crazy, crazy. And it was so ridiculous to her that you could go into a jail like Rikers Island or something like that. And there were literally 14-year-old girls. There's a high school in Rikers. Nobody sees a problem with that. Like, that's a problem. And really, their only crime is that they are underage and, you know, actually the victims of technically what is trafficking by the law. But we won't get into all of that. I was supposed to be light. That's not very light. I sound like the Brooklyn DA. But the point is that, you know, she wanted to talk about a lot of this stuff like 10 years ago, but she wasn't ready. And like you said, you never know what it's going to be, like when it's going to like appear. And like if Joe is trying, I always say, Sarah, por favor, don't try. If you're trying, something's wrong. You're supposed to be allowing. I know this stuff because I started meditating and everything, and it's really beautiful. And they talk about all about like, oh my God, you have to allow the breath, allow. When you start allowing, it just changes everything. If you can like give yourself more freedom to do less. They say, I heard this thing again, more meditation. I started getting into like meditation, affirmations, because you know what? I was starting getting like so stressed out and everything. Like, you know, I was in college and I was like, oh my God, people don't take me seriously because like I have an accent or whatever. And they assume like, you know, are you cleaning in here? No, excuse me. I'm cleaning with my mind, a book. I'm reading it. Hello. But you know, like I just started to like realize I don't have to worry about other people's impression of me or nothing like that. I just have to like affirm like who I really am. Sometimes I just like say these three little affirmations that always make me feel better. Sotomayor, Sotomayor, Sotomayor. It's like the three little words, you know, three little words. Anyway, you know, I'm being silly. But the point is that you have to do it like one joke at a time. Like just write your joke, write a nice light joke, have a good time with that. And then like rest.
I love you.
I love you too.
Thank you, Sarah. I'm going to leave it on that.
Love you, Luz.
I love you, darling. Stop trying.
Don't try. Just allow.
Just allow.
Allow the love.
And see where it leads you.
See where it leads you.
Honey, keep standing in the light. Stay on the right highway. Don't take those fucked exits Mm-mm. into terrible neighborhoods mm. where
and they only lead you to down. Bad rest stops where you eat a Cinnabon. You don't want to do that.
You don't want to do that.
You know you don't want to do
stay,
that.
Stay on the right road. We need you there. I love you. But that's not why you need to do it. You don't need to do it because we need you to do it.
It just that's happens a side to effect. Dovetail. It's a nice dovetail.
That's a side effect.
We like it.
All right.
All right.
Be good.
Thank you.
Bye.
You
too. Bye. Wow. Sarah Jones is a writer, a performer, and as you can tell, a force of nature. She's probably best known for her one-woman Broadway show, Bridge and Tunnel, for which she won a special Tony Award. And now she's hard at work on her latest project called Sell By Date, all about sex trafficking and exploitation. And podcast lovers, she is about to launch her own amazing podcast with Public Radio International. You can find a lot more about her at sarahjonesonline.com. We're going to take a quick break, but first, a word from our sponsors. So one of these things that I refuse to stop doing in this world is writing letters. It's a lost art in the time of email and texting and easy access by satellite to anybody in the world through Skype and a million other devices. A lot of people don't write letters anymore. I still do. I think there's kind of nothing better on earth than to go to your mailbox and have an envelope like written by an actual human being with a note on real paper in it. I do it all the time. I had a goal a couple of years ago where I was going to write a letter or a postcard every single day to somebody. So for that reason, you will not be surprised to hear I use a lot of stamps. I also dislike going to the post office. No offense to the post office, but it's far away and I don't like going there. And this is why I love stamps.com, because I can write all the letters that I want. They can be absolutely beautiful and I can print those stamps at home and I never have to worry about the office hours of the post office. I can do packages at home. I can send my signed books to people who I love. I can wrap up presents for people overseas and take care of it just without even leaving the comfort and the joy of my own desk. It's really good for me. It's also really good for small businesses. Stamps.com is pretty terrific, actually. And we're lucky because they are sponsoring the podcast this week and they're giving us this incredible special offer. Right now, if you sign up for Stamps.com and you use the promo code LESSONS, you will get a 4-week trial plus a $110 bonus offer, which includes postage and a digital scale. So go to Stamps.com. And before you do anything else on their website, just click on the microphone that's at the top of the page and type in the word LESSONS. As in magic lessons. That is the special promotion that is only available to people who listen to this podcast. So go to stamps.com, click on the little microphone up there at the top of the homepage and type in lessons and you will get a 4-week trial plus a $110 bonus offer, which includes postage and a digital scale. That's stamps.com and entering the promotional code lessons. You will not be sorry that you did it. Okay, a few weeks have passed. We have left Jo alone in the hinterlands to work on her writing projects, and now we're going to check in with her and see how it's going.
Hello?
Oh, hello, Jo. It's Liz.
Liz Gilbert.
It's been so long, darling. How are you?
It has, hasn't it?
However are you?
I'm terribly well. How are you?
You're so posh. You have the poshest accent ever to be on Magic Lessons. We all love it. What's been going on? This is your big check-in. I've got so many questions. Where do you want to start?
Well, firstly, in this country, I've got probably the least posh accent you can imagine. So thank you. Thank you for that. Everything's happened. It's been brilliant.
Wow. Start in the middle and go in both directions. Tell me everything.
Well, things changed pretty much from the minute that I put down the phone after our conversation. And honestly, I don't know what kind of magical pen you're signing those permission slips with, but it works. It works. The position I was in before, so I was completely stuck. I was quite far into the first draft of a comic novel that I was working on, and the fear had kicked in. I was starting to question whether it was worthy enough or weighty enough, and I kept like killing off my characters just to bring some drama, you know, and some gritty realism, which is what you want in comedy, isn't it? not at all. But then he gave me this permission slip, and pretty much straight away, I just started writing, and I just stopped messing around with the first draft and just started on the second draft. And I just absolutely went with the advice that you and Sarah Jones gave me, which is just to, you know, just let it come out. Whatever wants to come through you, just go with it. Don't question it. You know, just let it happen. So I just wrote it all down. And I'm about a quarter of the way through the second draft now.
Oh my God, that's amazing. Yeah. Have you murdered any characters lately?
Well, it does start with a funeral.
All good stories start with a death.
yeah, that's what's really interesting, though. I'm really enjoying it, and I'm really enjoying writing, you know, the funny stuff and the silly scenarios and all that kind of thing. But I am really surprised and sort of pleased, really, by the other stuff that's there. So there is darker stuff in it, you know, and there is hardship and inequality and loss and all this stuff. But I'm okay with it now because I'm not trying to put it in there.
Exactly.
You know, if it's meant to be in there, I'm absolutely happy to let it be there with the other stuff. And it's really liberating, actually.
Ugh. This is music to my ears. Well, you know, the thing about light and darkness is you have a lot of light in you, right? You're a really effervescent and bright and funny person. But as I've had it pointed out to me by clever, wise people observing me, nobody who has that much light cannot also contain an equal amount of darkness.
Yeah.
You know, just for the balance of the soul. And so in a weird way, when you were focused on the darkness, you weren't able to release it. In a strange way. But when you allowed yourself to be light, then the darkness had a safe home in a way. So it gets to have an organic place in the story rather than, you know, just being the oppressive homework assignment of what you used to be doing. So it doesn't surprise me that now there's a real home for those ideas and those thoughts and that grimness. And it's in a bright light, silly, absurd frame. Yay. I'm so glad to hear it. I can't wait to read it. So, so exciting. And what I'm loving is you just using the word enjoying.
I'm so enjoying it.
Like, since when do people have permission to enjoy what they're doing? Wow. What's that all about? What a radical way to live.
So it's been, I don't know, a couple of months since we spoke. And it's actually been a really, really difficult couple of months for me and for, you know, my family and my close friends. Mm. But it's been a real challenge for me, you know, to pursue this stubborn gladness that we were talking about. Mm-hmm. And honestly, the writing, it's been like a guiding light for me through a lot of stuff that's been going on. And it's given me something that's mine and sort of a place of stability, really, while everything around me goes crazy. And I really am enjoying it. I've had the most phenomenal, like, incredible couple of months, actually.
Wow. Wow. Memorize that feeling, and there's a word for it, what that feeling is that you're feeling, and it's called integrity. It's called integrity, and that's what it feels like. And we think of integrity as being this sort of moralistic, kind of heavy, oppressive word that doesn't have, I don't know, doesn't have joy and light and glamour in it. But when you're actually standing in your integrity, that's what it feels like. And things can go wrong all around you, and worlds can blow up, and people can have dramas and difficulties, and you can have dramas and difficulties. But when you're in that place and your integrity is the thing that you're doing that brings you to life based on who you really are, like what you really naturally are. And when you're in that place, here's the other thing that happens, and you may be finding this, may have been finding this over the last few months. People have no choice but to meet you with their own.
Yeah.
You know, and so everyone will rise with their own integrity to meet you at yours. And that's why it's a community service to live your own life with integrity. And integrity here, my friend Martha Beck, who also is coming on this podcast at some point this season, you know, she has a wonderful definition of integrity that I love and that just was a game changer for me. And she said, it's got nothing to do with cultural ethics and morals. And I'm saying this to you, especially as somebody who's been really kept hostage by cultural ethics and morals, right? It has to do with a sort of a structural integrity to the self. And she refers to it as almost an engineering integrity. Like when an airplane is in the air, if it has a rip in the seam in the wall of the airplane, that airplane will crash because that is not the design. That's a design flaw. Like that's not how an airplane is supposed to work. It's not a moral issue. It's not an ethical issue. It just will crash. And it's the same with our own lives. When you're trying to live with sort of rips and holes in you because of living in a way that is not true to what you are, your airplane goes down and you, Joe, start losing your hair as you did and start falling apart and you're of service to nobody. But when you're doing what you're doing right now, which is creating work that comes from a place of joy and curiosity and delight, then all of a sudden you're in your integrity and everyone else will meet you with theirs and everything is manageable. everything is manageable, even the really hard stuff, because your engineering project that is Joe is intact, you know? and then that means you can deal with like everything else that's going on, and it's so great. So I just want you to just take a sort of Polaroid of what it feels like to be you right now, because that is what integrity feels like, and that is what you get to be when you decide to be it. And you get to be that not just now, but always.
Oh, Liz, thank you so much to you and Sarah Jones. Honestly, because...
Our pleasure. Tell me about what it was like to listen to her talking to you. I'm curious how that landed on you, some of the things that she
honestly
had to say.
Right, because I live in the middle of nowhere. There's more sheep than human beings where I live. So, you know, and I've spent the last 10 years talking to second-generation emigres, so I've got no idea what's happening on the New York theatre scene. And then as soon as I heard, I couldn't believe how brilliant she is.
Isn't she amazing?
She's amazing. So I immediately Googled her obsessively and watched every TED Talk and everything she's ever done. And I just could not believe how amazing she is. And the advice that both of you actually gave during that conversation has just changed everything for me. I mean, I loved that when you said that nothing is wasted.
Yeah.
Because all the time I spent doing the PhD and all the campaigning stuff, you know, part of me has felt that that was taking the wrong path or that I've wasted time. And then another part of me felt guilty for not carrying on with all of that stuff.
Mm-hmm.
So to think that at some point all of that stuff is going to, you know, be used. And I think it is. I think it's all going to be used. And that was really helpful. And when you said life is long and Joe is young, I think I fell to the floor with happiness.
Oh.
I might get that tattooed on my face. People always say, life is short, you're not getting any younger, you know, get a move on, TikTok. Mm. And to just be told it's okay to slow down and just allow whatever, you know, wants to come through you to come through. And I'm more productive than I ever was. By sort of giving myself permission to do less, I'm actually doing a lot more.
Yes.
Which is amazing.
Yes. Yes. Everybody, listen to what Joe just said, everybody, because that's the business right there.
It's amazing because pretty much my entire life, you know, the day would start with me being really stressed out, making a to-do list of things, you know, I didn't want to do any of the things on the list. And it was all deadline, deadline, deadline. And the morning after I'd listened to that conversation between you and Sarah Jones, I got up ready to make my to-do list. And I just thought, I'm not doing it.
Mm-mm.
And I made a list of things I don't have to do.
The don't-do list. The don't-do list.
And it was stuff like, you know, I don't have to spend my birthday at Auschwitz, which is what
I did. Oh, my God. Is that what you were going to do?
Yeah, I did that about 5 years ago. And, yeah, even stuff like, I don't have to clean the bin. It's a bin. You know, it's supposed to be dirty. Just get rid of all the energy that's going in the wrong places.
Oh, my God.
And it was just really liberating.
Oh, my God. Okay, so I'm going to give you another. This is, again, stealing from Martha Beck, just because she's so good at this stuff. That yeah. sensation that you're describing right now of what you've felt like over the last few months, right, which is integrity, Joe. Which is you just enjoy and pleasure and producing and making what you want to be making. We're going to give that a plus 10, okay? And then you're going to find its opposite feeling and go back to some point in your life where, like, and I'm going to ask you to tell me right now a story of you at the exact opposite of that feeling, if you can come up with it, because I'm sure you've never had a bad day, but maybe you can dig. Can you give us an example?
Yeah.
I mean, birthday at Auschwitz is good, but I'm sure you've got better ones.
There's countless examples over the last 10 years. I think the main one I can remember is when I was supposed to give this paper at a conference. And honestly, I felt just so drained and so ill. And I had to stay overnight at the place. I was supposed to be the first person to speak in the morning. And I phoned my mum at about midnight, and I just said, I don't even know who I am anymore. I can't do this. I absolutely cannot do it. And what I actually did, Liz, I can't believe I'm actually saying this because nobody actually knows the truth, but I booked a taxi and I just ran away.
Good. Good. Good, because what I want to do is just send a helicopter back in time and airlift you out of there.
I actually ran away because it was just breaking point for me. And if I would have gone up there and done that paper, I think it would have actually broken my spirit. So I actually ran away.
So let's call
and then
that
I had to
feeling.
Spend time yeah. picking up the pieces afterwards.
Yeah,
but yeah,
yeah, yeah. But it was, but at least there were pieces left to pick up.
Yeah,
you know that
yeah.
you didn't detonate in a way that would have left you with no pieces left to pick up. All right, so let's call that feeling. Let's call that midnight before the conference, right? And I want you to just like and let's call the feeling that you have now summer of writing.
Yes.
So midnight before the conference, we're going to give that feeling a negative 10. And summer, and just remember, I don't want you to live in it because it's going to mess up your DNA even to like think about it. But just have that in your mind as like a framework of like what hell for you is. And it's not hell for yeah. anyone else, it's just hell for Joe.
Yeah.
And here's what brings Joe to life, summer of writing. That's a plus 10.
Yeah.
And then what you're going to do, and I want everyone to make these in their own lives too, like alternate a memory of like just your hell versus your heaven, right? Negative 10, positive 10. And then look at everything that's on your agenda for the next month and grade it based on that scale of how close it goes to night before the conference feeling or summer of writing feeling, right? And everything that you do not absolutely have to do, like, I mean, and really question how much it has to be done. Like everything that you do not absolutely have to do that goes on that negative 10 scale, you cancel. And everything that leads you more in the direction of summer of writing, Joe, you nourish. And and if you just do that again and again in your life, you start to create an integrity scale that, again, not a moral issue, not an ethical issue, just a structural engineering issue of how Joe works and what brings her to life and what brings her to death. And more of the plus 10 stuff, like year after year, year after year, and you're starting to live a life that will become a living poem of grace. And that's what you deserve, and that's what you're heading toward. And I'm psyched for you. It's awesome. Awesome. No more nights before the conference for you. No, no.
No, no more.
And
it's done.
No more. It is of service to nobody. Okay, so I also gave you, a bunch of assignments, but I'm just going to talk about one of them, which was I asked you to make a list of 10 people whose work has illuminated you, and I asked you to write a thank you note to one of them and to send it. Did you do that?
Yes.
Okay, tell me about that. What did you do?
I did. I did it straight away, actually, after we hung up the phone. And the point of the list was so that any time I felt that what I was doing wasn't worthy enough, I could get the list out and have a look at it and remember how all of these people had, you know, given me joy or happiness during, you know, my childhood or my life. But I haven't actually needed to take it out again. So that's good, isn't it?
Well, you're a quick study. You're a quick study, Joe. You got it. First try. That's awesome.
I did do it, and yeah. It was a really lovely exercise, actually.
Cool.
It was really lovely because I wrote to the comedian Eddie Izzard.
Oh, my God, I love him, and I know I met him. I interviewed him once for GQ years ago. He's such a lovely person.
I love him so much,
uh-huh.
and he just brought me so much joy. During a time when I was at school and I was having the most lousy time, I was really unhappy, and I'd come home and, you know, watch one of his shows and just suddenly be just turned around and feel really good. He taught me and so many people the power of just being yourself.
Yeah, talk about integrity.
Yeah.
Talk about integrity, that one. Yeah, no kidding. No kidding. So you wrote to him and told him all that?
I did. And it was really good, actually, just to write all of that down and realize how powerful that is.
Yeah.
You know, him being himself and doing the thing that brings him to life and the effect that that has on everybody else.
Yay.
But yeah, that was a really good exercise.
Lovely, lovely. And now that I know that you like Eddie Izzard, it makes even more sense to me that you would like Sarah Jones. So I'm so glad that I decided to partner her up with you in that way, because she's obviously perfect for you then. And I will pass that along to her and tell her that you said so, and that you're having
amazing.
Summer of your life doing what you're meant to be doing, and your airplane is in the air, and that's where it's going to stay, because now you know how to do it.
Thank you for that.
You're welcome, and thank you.
Oh,
and you're just
you so
such
much.
A delight, and truly, when you're done with your book, I would love to see it. I'm so proud of you, and I'm so happy for what's coming to you. Welcome to the team. and keep going. I don't have to tell you that because I know that you will. So lots of love to you, Joe, okay?
Thank you so much to you and to Sarah Jones. It's been amazing. Thank you.
All right. Bye, sweetie.
Bye.
So that's it for this episode. Thank you so much for listening, and I really hope you'll join us next time. Magic Lessons is a production of the Maximum Fun Network. Michelle Siegel is our extraordinary producer. Our theme music is by Dave Cahill, and it was performed by Dave Cahill and Dallas Vietti. Special thanks to Paul Ruest of Argo Studios and Jesse Thorne of Maximum Fun. You can hear all the episodes and find out a lot more about my comings and goings at elizabethgilbert.com. And of course, if you want to continue your own explorations into creativity, which I really hope you will do, it might help you to pick up my book, which is called Big Magic, Creative Living Beyond Fear, published by Riverhead Books. If you can, please leave us a comment on iTunes. It helps other people discover the show, and we appreciate it. And let's keep this conversation going on Facebook and Twitter. I'm at Gilbert Liz. See you next time.
Hey, you work hard, you play harder, you look great, and you smell fantastic. You deserve a vacation where you can kick back, hone your creativity, enjoy incredible comedy performances, and make some new lifelong friends in a maybe haunted inn in the Poconos Mountains. We've got The Adventure Zone, JJ Go, Joe Firestone's Friends of Single People, plus stand-up from Aparna Nancherla, Phoebe Robinson, Kevin Avery, Joel Kim Booster, and way more. Join us for Max FunCon East, September 2nd through 4th. There are only 10 rooms left, so head to maxfuncon.com and nail down your tickets today. Like now. Do it.
MaximumFun.org.
Comedy and culture.
Artist owned.
Listener supported.